Hello and welcome to episode 153 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my live streaming career as a radio presenter with one big regret. Never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter, and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. And on this episode, something a little bit different as I share with you a very special recording from the Here Comes the Weekend event in Woking just recently. Essentially a big Weller Weekender celebration brought to you by Nikki Weller and Stuart Debill. You're going to love this one. Let's get into it with a fabulous Style Council special.
Our next session is a celebration of probably the best pop group in the world. It is a real honour to be here, marking 40 years since the creation of the Style Council. Unbelievable, right? It really has been four whole decades since the reveal of a new venture from a fella you may know called Paul Weller. He'd been in a pretty small band called The Jam, and an absolute wizard on the keys, a lovely chap who, at the time, had locks of even lovelier hair. Sorry, Mick. A fella called Mick Talbot. Their band went on to release... Yeah, give it up. The band went on to release an incredibly diverse mix of singles, A-sides, B-sides, EPs, and albums that incorporated elements of jazz, R&B, soul, pop, and so much more. The music characterized by sophisticated and polished production. We talked a bit about that. We talked about the melodies. We talked about the catchy lyrics. Let's get into it. A real joy to reunite members of the band at this event today. We are joined by founding member of the Style Council. Please give it up, Mick Talbot. And we also have some fabulous honorary counselors with us as well. Singer Jay Ella Ruth, a.k.a. Jay Williamson. Give it up. Brass musician, arranger, the man on the trumpet, the flugelhorn, Stuart Prosser. And the absolute delight, but bear with him, he's just given up smoking, so he's going to be in here for an hour with us. This could be challenging. Bass player, Kemal Hines, a man so good on bass that Paul Weller tapped him up again in the 90s. Give it up, Kemal. Okay, right, so let's all have a seat. Let's start, Mick Talbot, with my Paxman-like questions. Take you back, summer 1982.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Weller's
yeah.
Come back off tour from Japan. US, Japan.
Right.
Meets up with you. Something you say woos him away from the biggest band in Britain, The Jam. What was it, Mick Talbot?
No, it's not quite like that, but, we had a lovely meeting and we got to know each other a little bit. I did a bit with Jam in 79 and a couple of live things. I didn't go on tour with them, but just played on London dates. And the last time I played with him, they got a Hammond organ in when I played a couple of nights at the Rainbow. And they did a kind of add-on set for the encore of four soul covers. And that was really enjoyable. And we did a bit of jamming at Gnomis Rehearsal Studios. And I think Rick and Bruce took a break. They went for some food. And me and Paul and Dave Liddell, God bless his soul, we all played sort of Booker T and Stax numbers together. And we just had there was a real connection, just the three of us. And I think that kind of, it boded well. You know, that was 2 years before I got contacted by Paul about a new project. But I think that was a turning point in our kind of musical connection in a way, you know.
So then obviously he tells the rest of the band that The Jam is going to be no more. There's the final tour, but presumably you're chatting throughout the rest of that year about what's going to come because you hit the ground running straight on like after New Year, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was probably like late August or something when I first was aware that they were going to split up. And he did say, you know, there aren't that many people that know at the moment and news didn't travel quite as fast as it might do now with the internet, I suppose. So if the cat did get out of the bag, there are only so many people that the thing could be pointed at, you know. So I was thinking, well, better keep this under my hat proper. It was quite funny in a way from my end of things, trying to sort of keep a lid on that really, because it sounded quite exciting and I probably wanted to tell the world.
You couldn't tell anyone?
Not really, no.
Did Shaney know? Did you tell Shaney?
No, I didn't even know her.
Oh,
then.
Okay.
No. I knew her about 6 months after that, but I didn't know her then. Yeah, I just swore my mum and dad to secrecy, and I think they're the only people I told, you know.
Right. And in the meantime, Jay, you were a fan of The Jam, so The Jam was a band that you were into. Was what Mick did here, clearly, you know, even though they deny it. Was that a big thing for you? I mean, you love that band, right? They were a big thing for you. You were singing their songs and all that.
When I was at school, and I was the only black girl in my school, I went to school in the era where teachers were openly racist as well as kids, because I hated school. But to get by from one day to another, I used to sort of sing every break. I used to I had a step that I used to sit on. I used to sing stuff. I really loved the Jam and Elvis Costello. They were my two, you know, amongst loads of others. So, yeah, I was very aware of who Paul was, very.
We'll pick up your story in a second when you join the band, but let's go through all of you and introduce us. Stuart, the Jam for you wasn't really part of your world until you actually started auditioning for the Style Council, when you learned like all of the Jam's back catalogue pretty much, right, for the audition, and then that wasn't needed.
No, that's right. I love the sound of the Jam and the whole soul and jazz, and little later on the jazz thing, which is what I was really into. But yeah, my audition came out. I was doing a lot of session work in London, and I got a call to say, would I like to play with the Style Council? I mean, who would say no? So I said, yep, that'd be great. Went to the Solid Bond Studios, and before that, I remember I thought I'd better learn some of the stuff. So actually, I got hold of as many copies of the Jam singles that had brass on, any Style Council stuff that was around, so the Café Bleu, etc. Learned every single thing, every note. Thought, great, I've got it nailed. At least I can't fail on that. Turn up at the audition, and Paul was in the control room. I think Mick was at the piano, and Mick said, right, what do you want to do? And I was about to say something, and he went, how about we just do a blues? I can't remember what key it was in, but you just said...
What does that mean?
Might have been in, I think it was just the blues. It's just, you know, a three chord traditional 12 yeah. bar blues. Yeah. And
I just had to then change my headset completely from, you know, I was going to play, you know, something from
the
Jam.
You're going to weave a bit of Malice. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And no, we ended up doing a bit of, you know, Kenny Wheeler, for those jazz fans out there.
It's not the tour manager, Kenny Wheeler.
Sorry, yeah. Yeah, good point. The other one.
You wouldn't want him blowing down anything.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And Cam, in the meantime, you're a musician. You know, this is your career. You're a working musician. You've got your own band going on. So what's the Jam going on? You're doing your own thing. Were the Jam part of your world or not? You've got the Central Line thing going on right then, right?
Yeah, funnily enough, I first met Paul in Holland. We were on the same TV show together, Top Hop, it was called. I think it was Top Hop, maybe. And they had several hits, as you all know. And we had a hit over there at the time. And he was just sitting down in one sector of this studio, and we were chatting away. Obviously, I knew all about his career, and he was really friendly and warm. And that was it. We just a brief chat, and we didn't see each other until I got this new device called an answer machine, Panasonic answer machine, little cassette thing in it, you know. And the first message on there was from Paul asking me to come and play on Our Favorite Shop album, having been to his studio and played some bass one late night. A little bit tanked, I must say, on a Dizzy Heights gospel song. And I remember really enjoying it and slapping all over the place on the bass. And he kind of liked it and invited me in to play on this album. And that's when I met Mick and Paul and Dee and Helen and went on from there, basically.
Cool. Now, the majority of you, in terms of your life with the Style Council, was through that live experience. And there is something very special about life on the road together. You know, relationships are formed. Bonds are formed or broken, depending on how the tour goes, right? But you know, in your case, you know, there were some really strong relationships formed on the road. And Mick, talk about the importance of the Honorary Council, because initially it was the very first marketing we saw was Paul and Mick. It was like a duo, the Style Council. But the Honorary Council was special for record and for live, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's just having confidence in people and being aware of what they can do. Sometimes we were helped. I'm going to bring in Dennis Mundy again. He steered us towards quite a lot of people that we didn't know. He was helpful with a lot of that, and I think he was the person who first enlightened us about Steve White. But once we were confident, or we knew people's stuff with Cam, you know, he was a big part of the Brit funk movement. It's just like he's one of the founding fathers, you know. And you know, I remember him in his little Mac doing Beggar and Company on Top of the Pops. And you've got to check it out on YouTube. There's some wonderful moves there as well. So
we'll see those later on the dance floor. I'm looking forward to that.
So, but it was all about that. And that's kind of comes from Paul. So it's from the top down. When I first worked with him, he's very trusting. If he thinks you can do something, he's got a lot of enthusiasm about it, and he'll trust you to do it, you know. And we were kind of fortunate. more times than often it worked, you know, and it worked with these guys, you know. Yeah. So we were lucky like that, you know.
But it wasn't kind of like a X Factor red buzzer type audition process where people sat in the waiting room, you know, move next.
Yeah, well, I think probably when I was just being a bit vague with Stuart, asking him just to play a blues, I think a lot of people can learn what is already there, and that's great. And if people can learn quickly, I think we were quite keen on, if we hadn't heard people, to give them something wide open where they could kind of express themselves to see if they had a sort of creative thing or did their own thing. So just to give them a bit more freedom and see if there was a sort of personality or style to what they were doing, you know, because that's a bit more than just copying what's gone, you know. And I think that was just, whether that's right or wrong, that helped us to see if people had a kind of individual spirit as well, I think.
Ajay, your audition process. So at the time you were at stage school, but I think you were working at the post office, I remember you saying to me as well, right? But yeah, how nerve-wracking was that? Was it a quick process? Talk me through the audition for you.
Well, I was a post office clerk, a job my mum got me because I'm not good with numbers. I hated the job. Straight out of school, there was a theatre group that met near Hammersmith Post Office in the Riverside Studios called the Black Theatre Cooperative. And someone who came in to cash the dole said, oh, you've got to come in to this drama group. And I thought, yeah, I will one day. And I did. And I think the third time I ever went, the director asked me to audition and I got a role in a Sam Shepard play, rehearsing in an old church in Archway, I think Jackson Lane, something. And I was singing Minnie Riperton songs in the loo because the acoustics were amazing. So he put a song.
Hold on, you went to the loo just to have a sing.
Oh, to sing. Well, yeah. That was my habit, wasn't it? I've got four brothers. I used to sing them to sleep until they were like, shut up. I was singing in the loo, put the song in. Yvonne French, she had her own TV show called Switch. I don't know if any of you remember. Just such a lovely woman. She came to see the play and she came up to me afterwards and said, Paul Weller's looking for a singer. And I'm like, yeah, right. She said, you got a demo, and I didn't know what a demo was. So I got myself a little four track. It wasn't a Tascam, it was some cheap knockoff. And then I asked a musician who was in Light of the World, who was in this play, to come around my house and help me do some demos. So we did a jazz number called Girl Talk, which is a Dakota Staton track, and a Gap Band number, sent into Paul's studio. And he called me the same afternoon. So I thought it was one of the guys in the play just winding me up.
Yeah.
So he's like, oh, like, Jay, it's Paul. And I'm like, yeah, right. Who is this? Is it you, Nat? Fuck off, kind of thing. And it was actually really Paul. And he's like, oh, I'll just send them, what's your address? So I gave him my mum's address because I was still at home. He said, I'll send a tape round. Can you learn these songs? And I thought, all right, if a bike ever comes around my house, I'll know. And the bike was hit at my mum's house in an hour. It was like, I can't even tell you the type of like butterflies I had. And I had 2 days to learn Money Go Round, two other tracks, I think it was. But Money Go Round was one that I was like, cool, that's high. It was a Thursday, I think it was, because I found my 1984 diary and I wrote it in there. And I had to walk into this big studio and there was a grand piano in the studio and Mick was at the grand piano. Paul was standing in there and my knees were like, just not like percussion, you know, my knees were knocking together. And Paul's like, all right, Jay, yeah, what should we start with? Should we start with Money Go Round? Mick started playing it and I'm like, Money Go Round, Money. And I sung two other numbers and Paul said at the end of it, because it was all a bit of a blur, but I did manage to get some of this in my diary at the time. He said, all right, Jay, go in the office, see me dad. And I'm like, go in the office, see me dad. Whoa. And I sort of like staggered into the office. John said, all right, Jay, come here, sit down, come here. He said, how much do you want? is that how much you want, a ton? Or something like that. And I'm like, what? Who? And we shook hands and that was it.
This doesn't sound like the most professional of setups, Mick Talbot.
No, but what she's talking about is really somebody like Yvonne French connected us with more than just you. We when we lost Helen Turner and she went on to do something else, we got Vivian McCone, who was a really good musician and an actress, who I've since gone on to work with her brother quite a lot, Ernie McCone. Yeah. I wouldn't have met Ernie without Vivian, and Yvonne French was really helpful, you know. We did The Switch, which is a program she used to present, a Channel 4 music program, but she was clued in and tuned into a lot of things. Yeah. And I think she was an actress as well. And I think she even worked with Mike Lee and people like that, you know. So she connected us with a lot of people. So that was always nice.
Okay. So I mentioned the fact that you and Paul are fixed. That's the heart of this thing. And then even Steve White is an honorary counselor D. Everybody coming into this mix. And at the beginning, you had Tracy Young with you on TV shows. You mentioned The Switch and DC Lee and stuff like that. But we're not going out on the road initially. You're doing lots of singles. The touring wasn't a thing straight away. But when it was, the two in the middle here are part of the very early gig. So the first gig they did was the Gold Diggers gig, which, fabulous gig, right? So this was 1984. And I mean, just televised on BBC at the time. And on radio, so just went on national radio at the time. I mean, no biggie, you know what I mean? And that was the first gig that you were part of, having, what, auditioned like a couple of weeks beforehand, probably, right? So, Stuart, talk me through that, because you had quite a big role at one point in that gig as well, didn't you?
Yeah, it all came around very, very quickly. So, again, you know, about like the audition, I prepared and everything, but in one rehearsal, I think Mick and Paul had said they wanted to put a sort of instrumental melody over your fabulous Le Depart. Flugel. The flugelhorn solo. I thought, yeah, okay. So I wrote something that they seemed to like. So that was great. And we ran through it a couple of times. And then literally a couple of days later, I think it was right. We got our first gig and it's in this place in Chippenham. And I thought, great, safe, small little place. Nobody will be there. Fantastic. Oh, by the way, it's live on BBC Two. And, you know, so it was, I don't know what Jay thinks, but it was, and it was fantastic to do, but it was, I was absolutely petrified. And because I had to do this flugelhorn solo, it was in the middle of the set, sort of, it, nice sort of natural sort of flow to the set, and the lights went down and we had actually quite a lively crowd in the front, some of whom
are here today probably.
Probably were, yeah, exactly. Anyone here today who's there? Wow, okay, fantastic. Hope you're at the back, you're at the front. I love your stuff. Who weren't necessarily a big fan of some of those quieter moments. Not you, but others. So I was quite scared about the whole thing, and the lights dimmed and it all went very quiet. And I had to do this flugelhorn solo, just me and Mick, which was terrifying. But after that, it was kind of, once we'd done that gig, I don't know what Jay thinks, once we'd done that gig, I felt we were pretty ready for whatever came next.
When I did the audition, I had no clue of Chippenham, no. But that just sort of popped up. And we were in rehearsal, so we hadn't finished rehearsing. I had nothing to wear. I think the skirt I had was my post office skirt, and my tights were my mum's burnt sienna, because in those days you only had three shades of tights for black girls, and hot chocolate, burnt sienna, and I don't know what the other one was, sandy colour. So I had my mum's burnt sienna tights on and some heels I couldn't walk in. You know, I was just like, and I just remember like shaking so hard, and I think that's where my IBS started.
Well, and as much as I'd love to dig into that more.
very delving interview.
This has been, I don't know if you're in the room, whoever recently scaled this up for YouTube, we can now watch it in like high definition. I don't know if you, have you watched it back? Is it just, this gig is fabulous. Yeah. Not least for some of the moves as well. So when you were rehearsing, were you, did that come into it, or was it just natural, the kind of moving around with Mr. Weller on stage and things?
I think Paul and Mick just chose the right energy, and the right energy, if you just put it out there, the right energy will come to you, and vice versa. So
okay.
Yeah,
nice. All right, well, let's talk about some of these live moments. I want to talk, actually, first of all, I want to talk about this idea of being a European, because I think it was back at the A Paris, but Paul talking about the fact that we regard ourselves as European. In fact, I'm trying to apply for a world passport. This is my world and I want to belong to it wholly. The first gigs were in Europe, not in the UK. Was that an intentional thing to kind of turn away from the Jam and do something different?
We initially did, we did do some dates in 83, and the first one was in Switzerland, and we all dressed in ski outfits, skiing jumpers. I don't know if it went down very well with the locals, but it tickled us. Yeah, that was really dipping our toe in, but we didn't play in the UK until 84 when Jay was on board and Stuart. I think we thought we'd get a more receptive audience in Europe. There was quite a lot of, tension about the Jam splitting. There was a lot of, a lot of people were quite disappointed, and I can understand that. I've said in the past, I'm still getting over Ronnie Wood leaving the Places, and that was 1975. But, so I can understand. But we felt that we had a lot more freedom. We wouldn't be inhibited in any way. And it helped us develop and try out a few things, you know. So we never did play in the UK until 84. And it was the first one was a televised one, you know. It's just like, well, why not jump in the deep end? And, you know, I don't know if we were ever very calculated or sensible about any of that sort of thing. But it's just like, well, it's got to happen at some time. Why not make it the beginning and build on that?
But usually you think a band would kind of work up its chops. You'd you know, you get match fit, if you like. You know, particularly a new band, new people joining, and then you do the big TV thing.
It's still, you'd think that, you know, but occasionally that's not always the way. I mean, now and again, when I've been in a pickup band for like a couple of Motown acts for something that happened about 7 or 8 years ago, I didn't know I had 3 mates in the audience. They really enjoyed it, and one of them surprised me, come backstage and just went, "Oh, it's brilliant. The band's so cooking. You obviously got the London date at the end of the tour." And I went, "This is the beginning of the tour and the end of the tour. It was just one date." Sometimes that's the way.
Now, I should note, should mention, actually, Cam, even though he joined the band as an honorary counselor later on, playing live with the band from, what, 85 time, actually was the first one on the panel to play with the Style Council, even though may not have been in the room. Do you know this? So it was on the remix of Money Go Round with Bert Bevans. Is that right? So Cam, did you... I mean, were you in the? Was he involved? Was Paul involved, or was it just with Bert?
You know what? You mentioned this earlier on, and I
you can't remember. That's a bit...
Well, also, I remember you for being on Long Hot Summer.
Yeah,
it was a remix. I
remember
of that.
I remember that one
where they didn't think my synthesizer bass line was up to it, and he had to replace it.
Well, yeah, it was. Yeah.
You came in as a "I'm better than Mick" thing. Wow.
No, they needed to make it something radically different. And what Kamel gave it was quite a kind of reggae sort of sensibility, as I remember.
It's all a blur to me, I can assure you. I do remember that. Yeah, it was, you know, you got a song like Long Hot Summer and that bass line there. I mean, you can't really match that. You can't really top that, can you? Let's face it. And we were of the era where dance music was asking and requesting record companies and artists and entities to do 12-inch versions. So I was obliging there to some extent. But to be honest, I knew that there was no way of actually interpreting something that could actually top what was already a classic. And that's being very honest about it, you know. So I guess with the directive, I can't remember at the time whether it was you or Paul who gave me the directive to do a bit of a...
I think it was all coming from Bert Bevans. I mean, yeah, he was orchestrating that remix. I don't think we got too involved in that because we thought, well, we've done it the way we hear it. We're interested to hear it through someone else's eyes, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I just done what I could at the time. I'm not even sure what it was, but it happened to work, and I got invited back, I think. Yeah.
Talking of remixes, I spoke to Brendan Lynch on the podcast, episode 150. It's out this week if you want to have a listen. He talks about the days of Solid Bond and this idea that in the morning you were starting the day, people were bringing in their favorite records, you were listening to music together and things like that in the studio. Was that similar on tour? What was the vibe like, Jay? What was the vibe like on that first tour in terms of, you know, listening to songs together, getting those influences and stuff, and forming relationships? Because that's what you have to do early. It's a long old day before you get to the gig in the evening, right?
84, I think I got my first Walkman. Or I had something in my headphones. I had headphones and music. I do know that. On the tour bus, we played films and music.
Carry On was a big thing, wasn't it? Was it Carry On?
Yeah, but I think I was telling someone the other day that, because someone brought up Malcolm McDowell, and I watched Oh Lucky Man and The Clockwork Orange on the Star Council tour bus. And I tell you what, I didn't sleep for about a week. It's absolutely freaking frightening movie. And I remember thinking at the time, but Paul and Mick are such lovely guys. I don't understand why they would watch such awful, evil stuff.
Can I just add something to that? Because I remember that really, really well. In fact, The Clockwork Orange, we had watched about 3/4 of it when we got to the gig in the coach. We did the gig, and the first thing everybody wanted to do was get out of the gig, back onto the coach to watch the rest of the film. It's like, yeah, great to see you all. Thanks for coming. Right, Clockwork Orange.
That was banned at the time.
Well,
wasn't it?
That's why it really had kind of some sort of, I don't know, we got engaged with it because it was quite a thing to have a copy of it, you know. I mean, the director himself, I think, got it banned. He didn't think it was suitable for public consumption, so we wanted to know what it was about, you know.
I wonder who got hold of that. Kenny Wheeler, I bet, got hold of that, right?
Possibly, I don't know. But no, it kind of intrigued us because this is a bit of a stretch to connect it. But I did read that Andrew Luke Oldham, who used to look after the Stones in the early days, he had actually wanted to make that film about 10 years before it got made with the early Stones. I think he had the rights to it in 1963 or something. And it came out in 71 or something like that. He wanted to make the Rolling Stones, the Droogs, the gang that are central to it. But that never happened. But he used to write their sleeve notes. And he used to speak in a kind of gobbledygook sort of fashion. And some of the vernacular he used was based on the original novel, which is all sorts of mad slang. Some of it's Russian words and little bits of dialect about different things. So the gang have got their own slang. And he wanted to sort of kind of project that onto the Stones. So he had the sleeve notes on the first two or three Stones albums are really quite unusual. And I think in a funny way, that kind of subliminally fed into the Cappuccino Kid and some of them unfathomable.
But people would pore over those things on the rear of the sleeve, wouldn't they? And try and work out who wrote them, what does it mean, all those kind of things. Yeah, yeah. Probably people in the room can memorize those and know them off by heart. You know, they were incredible things. Jay, for you, this was first time overseas touring with a band. And these lot are meant to be looking after you. And here they are showing you this horrific band film.
Yeah, it's the first time away from my mum. She was, even though she was really shocked and upset that I left the post office, she liked Paul Weller because I used to play the Jam in my little record player in my bedroom. So she kind of liked some of it anyway. And it's funny, my mum passed 4 years ago and her photo albums had all my Star Council pictures in there, and she'd written captions. She wrote the captions under them, not me. Like, there's a picture of John, got his elbow on the stage like this. He's doing something like, oh, and it was a sound check, and I got my camera and I went, chink. You know, he was like raging about something, and my mum wrote under it, and a final word from Mr. Weller. Like, really cute. But no, I used to follow Mick round a fair bit because
like a lost puppy.
Like a little puppy, because he's so funny. I like that kind of witty, sharp, really funny. And I think I just laughed an awful lot, like wet myself laughing with Mick's humour. I've got a picture of Mick in my my mum bought me a fake fur coat for my 19th birthday. There's a picture of Mick in my coat with my cousin's college scarf, you know, doing a Noel Coward impression and that kind of stuff. You know, it was just a lot of warm laughs and everything. I couldn't talk to Paul very much because I just didn't know what to say.
I mean, that's the final episode of my podcast, right?
I was a bit tongue-tied. Because, you know, he was from the Jam. So, yeah, it was hard.
Yeah.
But, yeah, but Mick and, you know, the guys, it was fun, yeah.
Now, I'm going to come back to the running race in a sec, Jay, and how you broke Paul Weller's arm. But first of all, Stuart, let's talk about Japan, actually, and Stuart and Cam. So, you know, Japan was somewhere that you went on that tour where, I mean, it's nuts. And Cam, in your experience of Japan with Paul, with the Soul Council and with Solo, actually, I think, the gigs over there were completely different. The crowds over there completely different. It was a very different experience, right?
From a number of different perspectives. I mean, clearly, you don't think about the culture being that different until you go there. And this is so early 80s. I'd never been anywhere like it. There's very little English signposting in the town, in the city, for example. But the big difference for I remember is that we had to perform quite early. The shows were fairly early in the evening, sort of 6-7 o'clock.
I'd bloody love that. Wouldn't that be brilliant?
and the audiences were basically asked to stay seated, which for the most part worked. But I do remember we did a gig in Tokyo, and we took the bullet train down to Osaka. We did a show there that was getting really because we settled in after all the jet lag and everything had gone. We hit our stride in Osaka, I think. And it was a fantastic show, but the audience were all sitting there. And I don't know what happened, but they started gradually to get up and start dancing. And the security people tried to get them to sit down again because it just isn't what you do. And it just kind of built and built and built. And then the promoter came out and tried to tell us not to, you know, to sort of provoke this wild behavior in these young people of Japan, a morally reprehensible band that we were. I didn't go down too well, basically. And there was a bit of argy-bargy, I think, at the front. And before we knew it, the audience were not only dancing, but they were rushing up to the stage too. And it was quite a low stage. So to begin with, we were all thinking, oh, this is great. It's going to be great. There's going to be a real big dance scene down here. Fantastic. But they kept coming. And and climbing up on the stage. So I don't know if you guys remember this, but there's a point we just suddenly went, oh, okay, and grabbed whatever we could and legged it off the stage. So we were taken back to the hotel. The next day we were given a police escort to the station in Osaka and kept in a kind of locker room. Do you remember? I got that photograph of us like a football team. Yeah. We were kept in a locker room until the train arrived and they could sort of whistle us out of town, clubbing a Western.
It's kettling, I think they call it now, don't it?
But you were allowed back. You went back.
Oh, yeah, we did.
That was right, what I thought, what I remember, isn't it? Do you remember?
Yeah. And I also think Osaka's quite a long way from Tokyo. And maybe they're kind of the rebels of, we were thinking, oh, maybe we should twin this place with Glasgow, you know, because it seemed they've got a sort of spirit that's not dissimilar.
Cam, your experience of Japan with the Style Council and Weller Solo, I mean, you're treated like almost like gods out there in terms of celebrity status, right? All of you in the band. This is not just a Paul and Mick thing.
I have to say, given the opportunity, that this ties into what's been really prevalent in my life about solid bond organization. Being in the creative industries, you know, we observe, and I've observed from a very early age, just the beauty of entities working at a very high level, a very supreme level. And I've been given the gift of working with these people here and the Solid Bond organization with Nikki and Paul and John and Kenny, an astonishing organization. I know you know that already, but from my point of view, it's been a backdrop to something in my life that is just unquestionably one of the greatest gifts of my life, because to observe the level of professionalism of this organization from an early age, from when I was with the Style Council to the Paul Weller Band, several times in Japan, in America and in Europe and stuff like that. We didn't have to do anything. Everything was taken care of. We had to do our jobs and we worked terribly hard. Going into rehearsals with Paul is no joke. It's like going to war sometimes. But seriously, you know, it really is. And when you come out the other side, you can play on any stage around the world and you can bring it on as good as anybody out there, because he's got an astonishing work ethic. To this day, that's my model of operation in the industry. And in Japan, it was epitomized, you know. Yeah, we just had to do our job and we were treated in such a wonderful way. Never taken for granted. Feet firmly on the ground. But you know what? It's just such a joy to have experienced that in our lives. And unfortunately, I had the best part of a decade in various facets of that with the organization, the Style Council and the Solid Bond organization. And I'll be forever grateful. I just have to say that given the opportunity here today.
It's nice, isn't it? Because I think that's lovely. I think it's also that thing of that benchmark is there, that when you then come away from that setup, you realize that that's not the norm.
God, I mean, it's totally the opposite out there, to be perfectly honest. I mean, you know, Jay and I have just been on a little bit of a journey now where I've been trying to actually implement some of those things, and it's nearly killed me. That's why I've given up smoking. That's a fact. It's true. Yes, you laugh at me, but it's true. You know, it's because that's some astonishing organization. And to bring the family ethic in the Style Council was unquestionable. The family ethic, that unspoken serendipity that we knew that we had to do our job to the best of our abilities and we had to do our homework really well. Otherwise, we were in serious trouble. But the journey itself was such an amazing joy. The fun. I mean, I can talk to you all year about the fun and the different aspects, but the fun, I mean, you know, touring Italy together, you know, playing bulldog on the grass in Sheffield and staying in beautiful places, remote places outside of towns and coming in as a professional outfit and being, you know, very sensible.
Let's talk about when Jay broke Paul Weller's arm. So so this was a race. Who challenged who to the race, Jay?
I think I was talking to Paul about how fast a runner I was at school. and that my 100 metres record was unbroken. In fact, actually...
Still is.
Last time I checked, which was only like maybe 10 years ago, it was still unbroken. So.
Wow. Oh,
don't you look at that. Get out of here. Stop it. Anyway, so... Paul said, oh, I'll give you a race. And do you know, he was really fast.
I would imagine he's like a whipper, isn't he? I bet he's pretty quick now, isn't he?
He was like, I had to, you know, make some effort. So we were, you know, bearing in mind, I'm a little girl and he's a tall guy. Anyhow, with longer legs. Anyhow, we were having a race to the tour bus. And I think we were kind of neck and neck almost. Or maybe I was like a nose in front of him. And I think he did this dive for the door. Because Paul don't like to lose.
No, I can imagine that, right?
At least that's my recollection of it. And he just took a dive for the door and a tumble. And I was just laughing because I thought nothing of it. Like, I beat you kind of thing. Or, no, I beat you. Anyway, he broke his arm.
But he's still furious about it. Because presumably that upsets the dynamic that evening. How's he playing? Playing the guitar much then anyway? Or?
No. We had to change things around. It was the actual date of this was April the 1st, April Fool's Day. And very sadly, it was the day that Marvin Gaye died as well. So it was just like the news that was coming through. It was just really odd. So it was a weird thing when we got the show together. But it was all hands on deck. We rejigged thing. Anthony Harty said he could play the guitar. So we transferred him from bass to guitar. And Dave Liddell played bass, I think, for most of that gig.
Amazing.
Yeah, so.
And Paul's in a sling.
Yeah, and we carried on like that. And we did when we come back from Europe, there's pictures of him at the 100 Club with a broken arm. No shows got cancelled, but we had to kind of adjust.
That's remarkable, isn't it? But yeah, the fact that they're not calling anything off, but also the fact that he will go to that length to win a race. Let's talk about some of the highlights in terms of songs. So initially, the 84 tour, I counted up the other day, I think there were like five instrumental, like jazz instrumentals, if you want to call that, on the tour set list, right? But again, you're bringing that diverse nature of the albums to the live stage, but different versions of things. I guess a song evolves on the road, right?
Yeah, they do. It's like some of those tunes really did take off live. I mean, not just the instrumentals. The instrumentals were a chance to give people a bit more time to extemporize. People like Steve White and Stewart and, you know, horn players soloing to try the flugelhorn version of Le Depart, which we didn't record other than on live versions, and a chance to really, I don't know, see what tunes work, like Strength of Your Nature. We used to dovetail with another tune, which I can't remember, but they seemed to work, and they took on a different energy live.
Stuart, remember, go on.
Was it Razor's Edge?
Yeah, maybe, yeah. Some of the covers that we did kind of might have been used with that. Yeah, and I also think that Head Start for Happiness really took off live. It's captured very well recording-wise, but live, that really was quite a highlight, and I think everyone always enjoyed playing that.
I mentioned the Japan gig. We obviously got to see that on the VHS, which I wore out, the Far East, Far Out gig, and then DVD when it came out, and the extras and all that, which was fabulous. But there's a wonderful version of It Came to Pieces in My Hands, Just Came to Pieces in My Hands, with you and Paul, and pretty much a cappella, I think. Was that must have been a real highlight on the tour, Jay, wasn't it?
Every time that was played, it was, I mean, there was tracks that I just absolutely adored singing, yeah.
And still, like what? Give me some examples of what were the ones.
It Just Came to Pieces and Head Start for Happiness. I was telling Mick a little while ago out the back, when we did Head Start for Happiness, I just felt like I was in orbit, just a happy girl, you know, and I still feel like that when I play it.
It's amazing, that, isn't it, that power of music to transport you back somewhere, whether you hear that song and you're transported, as an audience member, you're transported back to that live gig.
Yeah.
But as a member of the band, that must be the same thing when you hear something on the radio. It's like, Christ, yeah, that was my life, you know, 40 years ago.
Yeah, no difference in feelings, still as wonderful. Do you know, I wanted to just tag on to what Kamel said a little while ago, because Kamel and I have been in rehearsals recently for this Central Line gig. And yeah, again, it's that professionalism and the discipline that I learned in the Style Council I took through my entire career. And I got to be known as like such a professional singer with a really professional attitude who could like just bang off vocals real quick. And I learned that with these guys. So I just wanted to...
Nice. Was that something that came naturally? Were you aware of the responsibility you had to what was a really young crew? I mean, like Whitey was like 17 when he joined, for goodness sake.
Yeah, well, Steve was, he's quite unusual. He was very versatile. I think he played with like a lot of older people, and he did a kind of sort of dance band thing, which sort of like harked back to a lot of techniques that a lot of people his age, 17-year-old drummer, would have just dismissed and just thought, oh, that's hackneyed or old hat. but he had a kind of broad spectrum. So we were fortunate. That was something to build on. I mean, when I first met Steve, I was in a band called The Bureau, and we were at the Albany Theatre in Deptford, South London, and him and his mate Gary Wallace, who did do a bit of percussion work with us, were like little drum spibs. They had a secret source of drumsticks, and every band that turned up to load in, they'd just go like Flash Harry in the St. Trinity going, want to buy some cheap drumsticks, open up their coat, and it was just like that. And then just... And that was him when he was about 16.
Wonderful. Now, we're going to get on to the end of the band in a second. An emotional time for everybody involved, obviously. But let's talk about some of these huge, big gigs. Because one thing I love with the Style Council, how you were dialing it up into big things and then dialing it back down in terms of the number of people in the band. So Glastonbury being smaller, Live Aid being smaller, Wembley showbiz. And Stuart, you were part of that setup with this huge, big orchestra, the horn section, all that, at Wembley.
And it was very different. It felt quite different as well. Because from the early days, the gigs that we did, it felt like a really tight club band unit. I remember doing gigs in small places in Germany where the horn section, and we were in line with Paul and Mick. Come the Wembley shows at the very end, if you like, of that, we were kind of somewhere like 4 miles back on a podium at the car park. So yeah, it was a very, very different experience. It was still hugely valuable, but I don't know, the whole thing had... to my mind, had sort of changed a little then. The atmosphere was different. It was a much bigger machine. We'd just come off the back of a UK tour, I think, which didn't have the strings in, did it?
I think the lineup was sort of really bolstered from a strings point of view and extra brass because we were at Wembley and it was being filmed. And I think some of those rostrums and the space between the band and different sections was to help it be filmed better, I think. I do think the Wembley gig was a compromise of sorts because we were aware that we're going to be shooting a lot of that. So that had to be taken into consideration as well, which in a kind of way, it does my brain in a little bit because I always respect the punter in the room with you at the time. And I think, you know, if the film can happen, then that's a bonus. When you start compromising it, I'm in two minds then, but you've got to work out somehow how to do it, you know.
Now, look, it's Glastonbury weekend this weekend. I'm serious linking the heck out of that and hoping my skybox has got enough space. But we'll come on to the white jeans at Glastonbury in a second. First of all, I want to see if any of you remember this. This is a quote from Paul Weller, okay? He said, "One thing I remember about the Style Council is watching Mickey Talbert fall into his food, which was quite a regular occurrence. I remember we lagered up in Italy and Mick just went bong straight into his spaghetti. He was always falling asleep in bars too, and you'd paint his face with makeup."
Yeah, well, not all. I don't think I may have nodded off once or twice. You know, not everyone.
Well, you're also denying it's a common occurrence.
But I don't know that I got made up too often. I did get made up very well, but mainly by Helen Turner, I think. Who's my preferred makeup artist. When I did conk out, yeah, I might have overdone it on the, on the road now and again. But then it was only a few years before that I was on the dole, and I couldn't believe that I was,
you can't even believe that,
having a whale of a time. Probably too much of a whale of a time. But Helen did make me up rather well.
With a bit of rouge and lipstick.
Yeah, lots of things. Yeah, and I think that was in Japan. And I think, I don't even know if I conked out when I was with them. I think someone cheekily got a pass key and came into my room and did it. I think Dennis Mundy covers that, and I pretended that I didn't know about it and came down to breakfast as if nothing had happened with the makeup on and embarrassed a few people. Thinking, don't sit with us. What? What's the matter? There you are. I was, bending my gender long before it became the thing to do.
Let's talk Glastonbury. So this was like a really wet, horrible year for Glastonbury. White jeans were not they were obviously all the rage at the time. You guys were getting them from Europe. You're looking smart in yellow casts and all that. But white jeans at Glastonbury Festival in a muddy year was not a cool thing, Cam. Whose idea was it? Because you were like a fashionista as well. Was this your idea?
I tied in with the fashion. I quite liked a little bit of, kind of Lacoste and the white jeans and the orange jumpers and shirts and stuff like that.
The cardi around the neck and all that.
What I remember about Glastonbury was that we got there early. We got there early on a coach and it was like 3-4 foot of mud. And so we had a lot of time on our hands and we just got tanked, didn't we? We got plastered, basically.
Pissed on perno.
Like honestly. That. And so when we got on stage, I was a bit of a mess, I know that much. Yeah. And I had to play Mix Pro 1 analog synthesizer, and it often heated up and went out of tune. It went out of tune that day badly, you know. Yeah. But fortunately, because we was all so tanked, it didn't matter so much, and we were falling over risers and stuff like that. And somebody said to me in the paper the next day, there was a couple of us leaning over risers, looking up at the sky. It was all good fun.
Yeah. And straight off the back of that is Live Aid, like almost the following weekend, I think, or a couple of weekends later.
A lot of big gigs that year, yeah, quite frightening. I mean, the Glastonbury thing, it was probably Pernod was to blame largely, I think. But I think it was raining as well, and it was like a scene out of MASH, you know, the Korean War movie. I think the crowd were with us because it was raining, and we opened up with Long Hot Summer. We decided to rejig the set.
Yeah. Just absolutely take the piss. I love it. We also get a trip to Japan. We go down under. There's, you know, you'd expect you're flying from Melbourne to Sydney, but no, we're going to hire a train for that journey and decked out an entire carriage and made it a studio.
Yeah, we were lucky. I mean, the promoter that did that, nothing seemed too much trouble. And he said, I think he was aware that there was quite a thing with John and Paul. They didn't like flying any more than they had to. I mean, which is a bit tricky if you're trying to tour the world. But once we're in Australia, I mean, country that vast, it's like taking a bus to them. But it's just like, why would you want to be on a train for like 14 hours when you can get in a plane for an hour? But we did it. And he tried to give us a lot of things to occupy our time. So we had one carriage that had a whole set of instruments in it, so we could just go down there and play. So it was quite funny. It felt like you were in a bit of a, like a film or an episode of The Monkees or something. It just felt a bit surreal.
There was a lot of chat about the fashion. We've not mentioned Paul very much on this conversation, which is quite interesting, really, given how much important he was to the band. But, I mean, you and Paul talked a lot about fashion. I think Shaney was saying to me, like, you'd go on holiday together as well, all of you, and then you and Paul would just be chatting about threads the entire time, talking about fashion like a couple of old ladies, was how she referred to it, I think.
Well, yeah, I suppose so. I mean, when you kind of share a similar history, and Paul's like about 4 months different to me in age, we're similar vintage, and you kind of recollect on certain things. So, you know, you see eye to eye. You lose track of time, but I think, you know, we're being monitored by our partners going, do you realise how long you've been talking about trousers or something?
Like 11 hours.
It's a long flight, and it could be worse.
Now, look, we'll come back to that finale, but 87, 88, it gets a little quieter for the band. I want to talk about where we go off to, because Jay, you go off, Curiosity Killed the Cat, Name a Number, one of the best songs ever created, in my opinion, and fucking awesome. It's a huge part in that song. We've got the Brand New Heavies. Yes, give up the Brand New Heavies, please. Working with the likes of Michael McDonald, Whitney Houston, CeCe Peniston, Jermaine Stewart, Gladys Knight. But then it returns to acting, teaching, writing, producing, and so much more since. But still loving the music. That's always been something you're so passionate about. But the Style Council, when you look back now, was such an important part of your life and such an important part of the Jay that we see here, sat here today, wasn't it? It brought you out of yourself, yeah?
Yeah, actually, yeah. In fact, having worked with some of the best people ever in the world, like, you know, like I was telling my son the other day, just because he was talking about the JBs and like he's just discovered the JBs. You know, you grew up with James Brown, obviously, because I play everything in the house, but... And I said, oh, yeah. And I showed him the record that I sung the title track on a JB's album. He almost fainted. He's like, Mum, you've got to tell me more about your life. But my kids know that the Style Council, bar none, it was the best experience of my life for my career. Do you know what I mean? And I don't know if it's because it was the first. No, it wasn't. Actually, it wasn't because it was the first, because I was in a little reggae band called La Famille before the Style Council, very briefly, and it wasn't a very nice experience, actually. It was just a little basement band. But, Style Council, where I really cut my teeth and really learned how to be a professional singer and learned how to get on with people because, you know, I was just a quiet kid that came from a really violent household. Sorry, I'm not going to get into all of that.
But when you got on the stage, you became something else. Like, it was watching it.
Do you know what I think?
That person on stage,
I think I became the real Jay because I had to diminish myself in my family. But what I found fascinating, like Kamel touched on, was how a family works properly. So I was in awe of John. I was in awe of Paul. I just watched them. I just watched them interact, watch their family dynamics. There's so many different areas of my life that whole experience enhanced. So yeah, I have nothing but, even though like when I left, I was like, it took me quite a while to get over not being in the band anymore, because that for me, that was heartbreaking because I just loved it so much. But, you know, I'm a grown woman now and it was fucking fantastic.
There's a quote for the poster, ladies and gentlemen, a quote for the poster. Stuart, we talked on the podcast, so please do have a listen to this chat because I'm aware that we've only got kind of 7 minutes left, but you went into the corporate world, but also, folks, has had a number one classical album with no less than Mr. Hugh Bonneville, who's a good pal. So still dipping your toes into the music, but you decide to move away from music for a while, but you're obviously still passionate about it, but we're kind of getting more of you doing some more of that. We're going to team up with Hillary and Style Council and stuff, but you walked away for a while.
Yeah, I did. I got a straight job. Just for a while. Just for a while. Yeah. I played with some smaller, not well-known bands like Lehman Brothers. But it was just a time when I needed to have some different kind of stability. So I did that. I always played all the way through. But I'm happy to say I'm over that now. I've seen the light. And the number one classical album was kind of the start of that only a few years ago, which was great. And so, no, I mean, echoing what the other guys have said, the Star Council was probably the most important, most influential musical experience of my life. I learned a lot from it. Not just some of John's, I know you were talking about Mick's anecdotes, but John's anecdotes, you know. I learned phrases like, it's not a problem, son, it's a situation. And that's really held me in good stead for years and years. I'm still playing, I'm writing, I've got my own music coming out and working with ex-sax player of Culture Club on another project. And also, as you said, just talking recently, I bumped into Hilary Seabrook, the original sax player of the Style Council at Love Supreme Jazz Festival last year. And we said, we ought to do something together. And so we are doing something. So the Prosser Seabrook project is coming to ear holes near you at some point this year. Yeah, I try and keep the flame going.
Love it, love it. I mean, I'm sure a few of you probably picked up the odd swear word or two from John and Kenny as well. And card skills. I mean, were any of you in the card thing? No?
Well, I did join the card school just very briefly. I was not that well-versed in it, but I did quite well in a game with Kenny and John. And it shocked me a bit, but we were in Germany and we had a bit of time on our hands and I spent all my winnings. I bought the smoking jacket that I'm wearing on Walls Come Tumbling Down, where I was once again in makeup. Yeah, what of it?
There's a theme. There's a theme here.
Yeah, and some trousers as well. And Kenny said, what were you all done up like a 10 bob and bone? I just went, it's me winnings, isn't it? He went, you're not supposed to spend it. Get back to the table and lose it. I went, do you know what? You're so angry, I'm retiring from the card school.
I'm out.
And that was it.
Let's talk about that final gig then. So Cam, final gig, Royal Albert Hall. You just done Tokyo. It's gone down a storm. The new house music, the new venture, modernism, what's coming next for the Style Council. We get the Royal Albert Hall gig. And you had quite a big role in that final gig as well, working with Paul and Mick. This is a real... Who was there? Anybody in that final concert? Right. So we got like a real diverse mix of people coming up. It was Omar, I think, was on that gig, wasn't he? We got Dr. Robert... The greatest hits has just come out, but we don't play any of it. I mean, there's a bigger conversation there, but you got involved with Paul and Mick in that.
I was allocated the musical director role. Big mistake.
Kamel was good. We trusted him to do it, and yeah, it meant that we could get in a little bit later and do a bit of shopping, I think.
Obviously, a major transition in the music industry. It was morphing, right? And it caught up in the record company not wanting to make the right decisions with regards to the careers and stuff like that. And yeah, I took on that mantle. It was a great experience because I'll never do it again. But 16 people, you know, touring Japan and stuff like that is a real nightmare for me. But I could understand the relevance of it. And I learned a lot from it, as you do from things that you embark upon. You know, I learned a lot from that.
The Japan gig was broadcast on radio, so you can hear it. It's like a bootleg thing or whatever. And it's a really strong gig. It's a
funny
set, you know?
When I listen back to that Japan gig, I think, well, I'm surprised. I didn't know it's pretty good, actually. But the Royal Albert Hall, not...
Well, yeah, perhaps Japan was ready for more than Britain at the time.
Well, the remarkable thing is, like 18 months, maybe less than that actually later, that the charts are just dominated by that type of music, you know, so you were ahead of the curve.
Possibly, who knows, you know. I'm pleased it saw the light of day. It would have made more sense at the time, though, I think, that the album that got away.
Final question for me about that gig. Who was in charge of the fashions that night? Because that was pretty special, the kind of fluorescent outfits and the... the beanie hat and the Levi's looked cool, didn't they? But that did not look cool.
Well, I had my own version of that. I wasn't really quite in the day glow sort of zone. I had sort of long linen Bermuda shorts and I think I had two-tone saddle shoes. So I had a slightly different slant on it. I probably looked like a sort of a throwback to like a 1920s golf player or something who'd lost his plus fours and put some shorts on.
Well, there you go. What an absolute joy that was. The legend that is Mick Talbot and a panel of honorary councillors, Jay Ella Ruth, Stuart Prosser and Kamel Hines. Thanks so much once again to my very special guests. An absolute one-off, I'm sure, celebrating 40 years of the Style Council. Brilliant stuff. Now, don't forget, if you enjoyed this episode, you can head to my website to find out more. You can also get yourself some official merchandise in my store, including our pin badge and mug. Plus, if you fancy it, get yourself a virtual coffee as well. Hello to Grant, who's done exactly that. Hello to Duncan. Hi, Duncan. Thanks to you for your virtual coffee. Hello to Ian. Thank you, sir. Sean Wilson. Thank you so much to you, mate. Hi also to John Reed. It says, I'm so pleased it didn't end on episode 150. Keep up the great, insightful world you're uncovering for me, stroke us. Thanks, Dan. Well, cheers to you, John, for your virtual coffee as well. Hello to Rich Gill. Hi, Rich. Hello, Peter E. Thank you to you, mate. Much appreciated. If you want to get involved, just head to my website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. You can also get in touch on social media, on Twitter, at wellerfanpod. Plus, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and now Threads, just by searching for Paul Weller Fan Podcast. On the very next episode of the podcast, we go back to that Weller Weekender once again for a very special episode of Desperately Seeking Paul with Steve Nicol. The absolute legend talks about his time with the Jam on this podcast. Stay tuned. That's coming next. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.